This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show for your Wednesday. Stein coming up here about 4:30. Brett, I gotta tell you, I'm kind of geeked a little bit excited here about Blue State Ball. Just had a meeting, talked about lineup and stuff. Man, it's loaded, just loaded this year. I gotta see if I can coach Stein and Schechter to show up.
Oh, I think they'd be a hit. Yeah, especially Schechter.
I remember Cliff said he lives in Cincinnati, and he says, "Yeah, can you fly me out?" And I'm, no. But I mean, we'll see if he can join us on Saturday night. That'd be fantastic. Also, after we play the Jeff intro, make sure I'm going to, because he's usually on a euphoric high at that point.
Yeah.
Let's make sure we ask him at that point. All right. Well, we'll just say, can you make the Blue State Ball this year?
It'd hopefully, he doesn't create too many angry faces on the stream if we bring on Stein.
Oh gosh, I don't want to be in charge of the chat feature at that point, because when the minute he says, you know, both sides, and just god, oh, it's going to implode. They're going to implode. A lot to get to today. I want to start off though by thanking Todd Colin. Of course, we have a lot of great listeners. You guys have been fantastic. The sponsorship has been amazing. The people that bought the calendar were very – wow. We were stunned by that. You're helping to keep AM 950 radio on the air. Todd Colid lives in Spain. He'd love to go to our sponsors, but, you know, it's not a real convenient commute. So he basically sponsors the radio station for a week each month, and we do appreciate that. You can, too. Call 952-946-8885, 952-946-8885. 8885. His band, Just Folk, they got a brand new single called Last But Mighty. It's got John Cleve Richardson, who basically did everything on the song, all the instruments, everything. It's out on YouTube. We will get this out once again. Last But Mighty with John Cleve Richardson and Just Folk. We'll get the link to that a little bit later on. And thank you very much to Todd. And thank you very much to all the people who have helped sponsor AM 950. If you want to help make sure Progressive Radio stays on the air, by all means, go to am950radio.com, click on the membership tab, and you can become a member as well. And also go to the webpage to find out about Blue State Ball, because once again, that is coming up here. Not this weekend. This weekend, Stephanie Miller's got her big anniversary, Sexy Liberal. When is that? What time is that? Do you know?
Oh, off the top of my head, I don't know. I can probably let you know in a couple seconds.
Yeah, we'll tell you what. After we come back from the break, we'll talk about that. But you know, if you've not been to the Sexy Liberal tour, I have actually been to three of them. They're fantastic. They're absolutely fantastic. And so I want to make sure you do go and do that. You got that this weekend, and then the following weekend on the 17th, it is the Blue State Ball virtual this year with AM 950 radio.
And by the way, don't forget the morning after. We got the Tom Hartman virtual brunch.
That's right. We've done something like this every time. Tom has always pulled a select group of listeners aside and had a Sunday brunch. Well, we're virtual again. So we're going to be doing that. The information for that, they can get the tickets for that as well. That's up on the am950radio.com.
Yeah, we just posted it. I redid the website a little bit, so there's two big buttons there that say buy your tickets for the Blue State Ball or buy your tickets for the Tom Hartman brunch.
All right. Or, of course, you can go to my OnlyFans page and, well...
Oh boy.
Needless to say, spring has sprung. Well, I know I can't cross promote only my OnlyFans page, but hey, drink it up. 952-946-6205. Hey, do you want to hear a story about a complete and total idiot?
Oh, let's do it.
Minnesota man refuses to take down his Trump 2020 flag. That's in violation of city ordinance. Jay Johnson, the moron, is flying a custom-made flag on a crane at his construction business in Buffalo. Johnson said...
This isn't Jeff Johnson, the guy who ran for governor, is it?
I don't think it is. Jay Johnson.
Jay Johnson.
Not
what?
Jay, the letter...
Oh, not the letter J. Okay, all right.
J-A-Y Johnson.
Throw a little shade there at the former gubernatorial candidate. All right, anyways.
Anything to stay relevant, right, Jeff Johnson? This Jay Johnson had to say, it looks small because it's 100 foot of feet in the air, but it's a pretty big flag. Thanks there, Johnson. He says he took down the flag, which measures 50 feet by 30 feet after the election, but decided to put it back up last month. Not long after several of his work vehicles had their apparently window shot out with a BB gun, police are investigating. I'm willing to forgive the people that did that. You are? That's just, you are? Okay. They just got to come forward and admit it, and I put a reward out. Well, you're not forgiving them if you put it... Never mind. Now Johnson is in violation of the law. Buffalo City Ordinance says the sign that big needs to be licensed. And by the way, that's a really common thing with pretty much most places. You can't just put up a highway truck stop size sign in the middle of Minneapolis. Remember, they had the whole big thing in Minneapolis with the RBC building, that new building they're building down in the old where Nicollet and Hennepin come together there. They were going to put a signage on that, and they had some big issues with that.
Oh, yes.
Remember, the Wells Fargo people got into a big fight with the U.S. Bank people about a sign over on that side. A lot of communities have rules about this.
Didn't the Twins get in some trouble, too, or was like Target Center? They wanted to put some big signage up, and I think they ran into some city ordinances.
Yeah, exactly. You're right about what they were going to design the stadium around. You're right. I remember that. So, you know, it's a pretty common thing. You have a ordinance because you just don't want people putting out their, you know, Paul's Porn Hut. It's like, oh, stop on by Paul's. You don't want that kind of thing. So you basically have rules and regulations stopping this. And the city of Buffalo is like a lot of other cities. He has not applied for a license. The city official says they're determining how to proceed with enforcement. I'll just put it up someplace else. Maybe even a bigger flag, said Johnson. How much of a moron is this guy?
What is it with Trump supporters? The bigger the flag, like the bigger your support is of the guy.
He says the flag cost him $1,000.
Why?
And the crane to put it up is $50,000. Now, I'm presuming you got the crane for another job things, but, you know, you are, for every day you have it out there holding a Trump flag, it's, you know, you're wasting that $50,000 on other things. I'm prepared to get the fines, ultimately get cuffed, go to jail, whatever, he said. Neighbors who see the flag every time they leave the house have mixed feelings. It doesn't really bother me much. It's just weird seeing it out there, said Patrick. And like they're campaigning again for 2024. Oh, I can tell you right now, after he just robbed, Trump just robbed, stole his supporters' money blind. I'll get to that with Stein. I don't think he's running again. He's not going to get the donations he got the last time. Okay, so you spent $1,000. Do you know how many people in the city of Buffalo, hungry kids, you could have fed for how many days with that $1,000? You could have. Instead, you said a Trump sign ain't enough. I want the big Trump flag. Take that little... Oh, Minnesota went for Biden? Oh, okay. Sorry. Well, didn't work. But hey, you know, don't let that stop you. The fact you spent $1,000 to try to convince most people in Buffalo, who are pretty much going to vote for Trump anyway, probably, to vote for Trump, and now that he's lost, and let it encouraged an insurrection against the United States of America, don't let us get in the way of you, as a complete moron, putting that flag up some more. Good for you. Wow. He's dumb. I mean, he is D-U-M dumb.
I can't think of a single politician I would ever spend $1,000 on a flag.
Not for a donation.
Yeah.
Just for a flag, which is you have to have some sort of reinforced auto dealership flagpole.
Oh, yes.
Or a crane to fly. What are you going to drape it over your house while you fumigate for bugs? I mean, I should give these people ideas. I shouldn't be. And the funny thing is this. I was just up in Monticello, and I went to in Big Lake Monticello. I mean, that's big red territory in the state. You drive out in the country. I mean, I was out there September. I think it was out in September. Trump flags everywhere. Trump signs everywhere. Not a surprise. It's a presidential year. You go out there now, not a single one. even the people in his bread and butter, even his strongest base, they've acknowledged he lost. And thank God he did, because Joe Biden's been doing a pretty dang good job so far. Economy's coming back. He's getting a lot of people vaccinated and fast. Feeling pretty good about things right now. And every time one of those people in those conservative districts goes and gets a vaccine and they say, well, Joe Biden and Governor Walz got this out, that hurts your cause even more. But don't let us get in the way of you flying a flag for, once again, and I'll get to this with Stein, a man who we now discovered purposely stole money from his own supporters. Millions of dollars. Did you see the one person? They have cancer, they're in hospice, and the Trump campaign purposely drained their bank accounts for a person with cancer in hospice. But hey, no. You sort of think that maybe that we're going to think you're smarter or something like that? No, I think you're an idiot. Jay Johnson, I think you're a complete and total moron. I really do. You wasted $1,000 on a flag. I mean, and granted, you don't want to feed hungry kids. You don't want to help out sick people. You don't want to build shelters or anything like that. You could go buy yourself a really, you know, a good used jet ski, maybe. You can go get yourself a real nice TV. Go get one of those. I mean, or you could, I don't know, invest it.
You do anything except that's up there among the dumbest things you could do with $1,000.
And he just sort of like, you think I'm stupid? Well, hold my beer. Let me show you how stupid I am. Get my crane out here. Hey, I don't know if he's aware of this. Maybe the Buffalo newspaper is just not good. Donald Trump lost the 2020 election. I know. It's been a delight. And they kicked him off of all social media. But hey, you're winning with your flag, moron boy. You sure are, Jay. Oh, gosh. I mean, that's just, I love belligerent and stupid. That's just a delightful combination. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. I do want to mention as well, Brett, now that you're here, we do know exactly what caused the car crash for Tiger Woods.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I heard about this.
There's a little bit of a lead foot. Not a little bit. Holy cow. Excessive speed. His SUV was driving 84 to 87 miles per hour on a downhill stretch of road outside of Los Angeles. So this was not on a interstate or a U.S. highway. He was on a road with a 45-mile-an-hour speed limit, was driving nearly twice the speed. He went off the road at 84 to 87. He hit the tree at 75. No traffic citations were issued. They weren't? I think there should be. I don't want to put, you know, add insult to injury, but 90 miles an hour. I mean, if he would have hit someone besides him, you know, he injured himself. If he would have hit a kid, he would have killed him. He's lucky no one else was injured. There's no evidence of impairment or distracted driving. Now, let me hold on. Impairment, he was driving 90 in a 45 zone, or near 90 in a 45 zone. That would seem to be a little impaired on the judgment level. They don't have probable cause to get warrants. Investigators, however, did search the SUV's data recorder, known as the black box. They blame the crash solely on the excessive speed and Woods' loss of control behind the wheel. Sheriff's Captain James Powers, who oversees the sheriff's station closest to the crash site, said there was no evidence that the golfer braked throughout the wreck, and it's believed Woods inadvertently hit the accelerator instead of the brake pedal. Really?
Talk about the benefit of the doubt for him.
Oh, dear Lord. This is the kind of, I get it. It's Los Angeles, and there's celebrities and stuff. But, you know, it reminds me of when Bill Murray was on the stand in Ghostbusters 2 and Rick Moranis is supposed to be questioning him, and he's telling Rick Moranis what to ask him on the stand. You see, we're very innocent. Yeah, that. Thank you. Thank you very much. that's wow. That, I, you know, you still, even if he accidentally hit the accelerator, even if he did, even if we go with your argument, he should still get a ticket because he was doing near double the speed limit in a 45 zone.
The most shocking part of that, still 75 into a tree,
and he went off the road.
How did he survive?
I don't know.
I mean,
he did hurt himself pretty bad. I mean, he was injured quite a bit. Well, you know why? I mean, these cars today, these ones that are built, they're built to survive stuff like that. I mean, the airbags and the – don't get me wrong. He injured himself. But considering, you know, it is truly a miracle that he survived. And the reason why is the car probably had enough airbags and stuff that kept him from flying out of the car or, you know, really getting, you know, getting dead. I mean, let's be honest about it. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. Minnesota coronavirus update when we do return. Jeff Stein, plus a full rundown of the Chauvin trial. That's coming up here in the 5 o'clock hour. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. Richard is watching the radio show. Hi, Richard. How are you? He is saying Stephanie Miller's 10th anniversary show, Sexy Liberal Show, starts at 8 p.m. Pacific time, which would be 6 p.m. It was 8. No, that can't be right. 8 p.m. Pacific time would be 10 p.m. our time. So it's going to be 8 p.m. Eastern. See if you can find it.
I'm trying to figure that out here. I do like that on her tour, though. I know Donald Trump won't be watching because their special guest is Rosie O'Donnell.
Oh, Rosie's fantastic. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Let's get into the coronavirus update. We got Stein coming up here in just a moment. Hospitalizations rose above 500 in Minnesota for the first time since late January, prompting medical officials to warn of the continued threat of pandemic and the urgency for people to take precautions and get vaccinated. Once again, I want to be very clear here. This is being caused by people going on vacations, flying, going to places, not wearing masks while they're on vacations. This is about kids' sports, and it's about schools, kids' schools. That is what's causing this, for goodness sakes. We know what's causing this, and it's then you hear, like, the story yesterday. We were talking about the nurse that's flying down. It's like, you're a nurse. You should know better than going down there during this time. Dear Lord. The 538 COVID-19 hospitalizations in Minnesota included 138 patients needing intensive care due to breathing problems and other complications from the infectious disease, which caused the exposure of the coronavirus. Hospital leaders have reported fewer deaths and better outcomes among the cases, possibly because of progress in vaccinating the greatest at risk, but said many of the sheer numbers are putting pressure on the capabilities at a time when they're treating many non-COVID patients as well. And did you see that there was the story that's out? That was just a terrifying story in regards to psychotic episodes. I want to make sure I've got this correct here because I saw this and I said, holy God. It has to do with the long-term effects of this. In 1 in 3 COVID survivors received a neurological diagnosis within 6 months of infection. 1 in 8 with first ever diagnosis, a neurological diagnosis, says study risk of 230,000 patient records. Also, COVID patients had a higher risk of dementia, anxiety, Parkinson's versus the flu. So there are long-term life-altering health consequences for coronavirus. There are, once again, 1 in 3 COVID-19 survivors received a neurological diagnosis within 6 months of infection. 1 in 8 that was the first ever diagnosis they've ever had, plus higher risks of dementia, anxiety, and Parkinson's. This is scary stuff. And what's terrifying is the amount of people who clearly are not taking this seriously. The metro areas are as tight on beds as they are late fall, said Dr. John Hick, Hennepin healthcare physician, who has advised the state on the pandemic response. COVID-19 patients make up a lower percentage of hospitalizations now compared to fall. He says the case counts are starting to rise rapidly in several weeks of steady rise. The latest wave shows similarities to the prior spring and fall pandemic waves when hospitalizations surged about 2 to 3 weeks after diagnosed infections increased. The state on Wednesday reported a 6.3% positivity rate for diagnostic testing. Reminder, we were down to 3.5 at the beginning of March. It's 6.3 now, well above the 5% caution threshold. 19 more COVID-19 deaths, 2,000 and more infections. The state's totals in the pandemic are now 6,908 deaths, 532,658 infections. Think about 532,658 infections. You know, obviously you want to minus the near 7,000 people who died, but that means near 525,000 people could have long-term health care crises because of this. Holy God. Vaccination progress could prevent the increase of COVID-19 deaths that follow rising hospitalizations. The latest White House COVID-19 team report on Minnesota released Tuesday ranked Minnesota 10th worst among states for its rate of new infections, the 12th worst for the rate of new COVID-19 hospitalization admissions. However, the state only had the 40th highest rate of COVID-19 deaths in the seven-day period ending April 1st. Thank God we have gotten over, I think we did get over 80% on the most vulnerable people getting vaccinated. That is a big part of the fact that we've been able to keep the death count lower, although 19 today is not exactly low. I get it. You want to travel. You want to go out and put out a Facebook or a TikTok video or an Instagram post where you're drinking a drink at the pool. Look at me, a palm tree behind me. I get it. I want to go out too. But for God's sakes, this is not over. This is not even close to being over. Kids' sports, schools overall, dear Lord, we talked about that yesterday. Things apparently getting bad in Canada now, too. Travel to Canada from the United States is being discouraged by the Centers for Disease Control, saying that even those who are fully vaccinated could be infected and spread COVID-19 variants. The CDC rates of COVID-19 travel advisories from level 1 to level 4 has labeled Canada a level 4 danger zone. The highest level warrants following advice from the CDC, travelers should avoid all travel to Canada. Because of the current situation in Canada, even fully vaccinated travelers may be at risk for getting the spread of COVID-19. If you must travel to Canada, get fully vaccinated before travel. All travelers should wear a mask, stay 6 feet away from others. The warning from the CDC comes just after the U.S. Representatives Fischbach and Stauber, both Republicans, encouraged the reopening of the Canadian border due to the impact. Let the zombies in! Let the zombies in! For God's sakes, you idiots. Canada closed its border to the U.S. for non-existent essential travelers in March of 2020. More recently, current emergency regulations were issued to mandate anyone else. Like America, it varies depending on where outbreaks are happening. According to the CBC News, Ontario is expected to go into a 4-week shutdown beginning on Thursday that will see all non-essential businesses ordered closed. Medical officials from Toronto and Ottawa have urged province leaders to issue a stay-at-home order while schools in the Toronto area have moved to distance learning. Ontario borders the U.S. from the Minnesota East Coast to the Great Lakes of the Ohio Valley. The other Canadian province to border Minnesota is Manitoba, where health officials are worried about a variant-driven third wave being fueled by gatherings from Easter weekend. Meanwhile, a variant-driven spike is also occurring in Canadians' westernmost province, British Columbia, where the B117 and P1 variants are leading the rise in case levels. Both variants are more contagious and capable of causing more severe illness. Is now a dominant strain in Minnesota, which was also the first state in the U.S. to issue genomic sequencing to confirm a case of P1. As of last week, the state health department had confirmed only 3 cases of the P1. That's the Brazilian strain, if I'm not mistaken. That's the Brazilian strain. But yeah. For God's sakes, I get it. Look at me partying on the beach. Woohoo. I mean, do you not hear the amount of, once again, the neurological one in three people that had coronavirus had a neurological diagnosis within 6 months of infection, also have higher risks of dementia, anxiety, and Parkinson's. This is not a fringe study. This is 230,000 people were studied. We're only as safe as the people are willing to basically follow the rules. And right now, kids' sports, they don't seem to be wanting to follow rules. And people seem to be thinking, well, coronavirus over, and they're traveling the world. And this is going to get worse before it gets better. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We'll get into national news with Jeff Stein when we do return. It is the Matt McNeil Show on AM 950. Jeff Stein is our national and presidential expert. You can find his books over at Next Chapter Books. Also, as well, at totallyiowa.com, the Iowa Business Reports, his daily show. Of course, the Iowa Politics Report comes out of KXEL in Cedar Falls, Waterloo. Hi, Jeff. How are you?
Oh, I can we come back to me? Because I want to order my tickets for the Blue State Ball, and I don't want to be left out.
Well, do you want to come? You want to speak? I would love to.
Now, here's the thing. Do you want to come to a virtual event? I mean, that's a hollow invitation.
No,
right?
I don't.
It's not like in the past when you were kind enough to say, come to the Twin Cities, you can sleep on my couch. You know, that was an invitation.
We don't want Typhoid Jeff up here, though.
COVID spreader. That's me.
COVID spreader. Like one of those farm tractors, just like a honey wagon. COVID spreader Stein.
I think that was my high school nickname.
Yeah. really. I will say this, Jeff. That's too loaded. If you do want to, I would love to have you there. If you want, if you got some time, we can fire up a Zoom on your computer. Let's have you come to the Blue State Ball.
Your chat function would explode.
It would be fantastic.
People are coming for a good time. They don't need to hear from the line. They sure don't need to pay for it.
Well, they're going to be – well, we got plenty of other people that are worth the money. I mean, you think they're paying for me? For goodness sakes, no. We're already going to have to deal with probably at least – I'm going to guess. What's our over-under, Brett, on naked person? We're going to have to throw out of the virtual Blue State Ball.
Are you included on the list?
No, I'm on staff. I'm okay.
We'll go two, maybe.
Two besides myself. So
the contest rules say that we do not include staff members. So that's very important, yes.
So, no, I'll tell you what. I'll talk with you. Let's get you come on out. This will be fun because, I mean, everyone on the station is going to be there. Stephanie Miller, Tom Hartman, John Fugelsang is going to be there, all the hosts here on the station. It'd be great. Since you've been with us for 10-plus years now, 11 years, by all means, you're more than welcome.
Well, it is a tremendous lineup you have on the station, and I would not want to do anything to sully the reputation that you're trying to build.
So that still doesn't answer if you're going to be there.
It really didn't.
So, no. We'll talk. I'll talk to you about it. A listener pointed out that Tom Hartman on the station has actually been talking about the way the Trump campaign was collecting donations that were made online. And now the New York Times, I believe it was the Times, did a full expose on this and showed the Trump campaign. They did a pretty sneaky thing. They changed the automatic deduction feature on a donation to where the standard donation was signed up as a regular deduction versus something that you usually have to sign up for. And that for you to not have that happen, you had to read all the fine print and actually go click a box at the end of the fine print, which most people don't do. So the Trump campaign switched that feature around, started draining people's accounts. It got so bad. There's one story of a woman who had cancer, was in hospice, and they actually drained her checking account. Finally, I think it was the credit card companies ordered the Trump campaign saying, this is unethical, you can't do this, and give the money back. Let's talk about the fact that I know you like to say both sides do things. I've never heard of anyone basically switching around the default settings on a donation to where the automatic donations would be kicked in automatically without telling people very clearly that this is what's going to happen.
I only say both sides do it when both sides do it.
Yes, true.
This is a little different. Here's a different both side. Is it Trump getting the RNC in trouble or is it vice versa, or were they in cahoots? This is the part that may have longer lasting implication. If you've got a Trump for President campaign, Trump for President 2020, separate corporation from what they're doing now, separate from 2024, that becomes an entity that no longer has life. In other words, for whatever punishment they might get, that was that entity. This is a different entity. But remember how the RNC, Republican National Committee, and the Trump 2020 campaign merged operations. They merged databases. They merged staffs. It was very clear, and he was his people were controlling the RNC and, you know, vice versa. It was just open door both directions. So if the RNC has its fingerprints on this at all, because again, for them during the 2020 campaign, Matt, there was no distinction. Well, if there's no distinction, what trouble is the RNC going to be in now and moving forward?
Because there are legal financial consequences for something like this. I mean, let's face it, for the credit card companies to say, whoa, what are you doing? No, you can't do that. You can't do that.
The credit card companies who have virtue and ethics, then you know you're in trouble.
Well, seriously though, I mean, the fact that they were even like, oh my God, you're doing what? No, you can't do that. The fact that they did this, I mean, we know that Trump, he makes money. This is kind of what he does. He puts out a steak. He puts out a wine or builds a building. And he labels it, tries to make as much money as he can, as quick as he can, because he knows generally this is going to sour. This seems to be the same exact thing. He knew that he was, it was looking like he might lose. So he tried to get as much money as possible. And then, you know, you're right. He doesn't really care. I mean, you know, whether or not he'll even be in the country in a few more months, I don't know. But at the same time, the RNC is in trouble. What kind of legal bite is there, do you know?
Well, I don't think necessarily for him as the candidate himself, because he's certainly going to – his people over the course of time have insulated him for the idea of plausible deniability. And it has worked so far. I'm not saying it'll work going forward with some of these tax returns and various other things. But I think a fair assessment of the record is that he has been able to insulate himself from bad decisions and illegality because he can claim plausible deniability. These were people who worked for me. So if, in fact, that little palace guard is still in place, he may not have direct liability. But is it going to crater the multiple efforts that he's engaged in now to raise money? And there are multiple efforts, not just ones that have his name. He's blessed certain other ones. And that has gotten the RNC's nose out of joint because they want to be the one controlling all of the money that comes in for 2022. He's not letting loose. So I think the story you've given is completely accurate in terms of what does it mean for Trump. And my thought is, well, they'll segment the elections, doesn't mean much for him. But the RNC, the lasting damage to them, twofold. One, of having merged their operations with a guy who now won't let loose of the database so that they can raise their own money. That's one. But two, did he get them in trouble because of a merged operation? And what's that going to do going forward? It's, you know, you and I have talked for 6 years, let's say, that Trump is not a Republican. Well, he wasn't, he isn't, and he won't be. And his followers are not Republicans, they're Trumpicans. And so he does not have the best interest of the party at heart. He has the best interest of his best interests. Mm-hmm. And now you've got the RNC sitting there, just as so many elected officials in Washington who are already trying to make peace with things. They're now saying, okay, was that 4 years worth it?
Well, I can tell one thing, I guarantee you, no one will ever, I mean, if Pence is, say, the on the top of the ticket in 2024, they're never going to allow the campaign and the RNC to work together again like this, because they just got shown why you don't do that.
Did you see where Pence has now come out with a new it's not a think tank, but it's very much it's like a steering committee. Okay, I can't even remember what they called it, but he's got some phrase and he's got all of these names on it and they're all Trump people. Mm-hmm. It's everything from Kellyanne Conway to, you know, up and down the line. okay? And he, in the announcement saying that he was forming this group, it's all these people from Trump world, and he keeps using phrases like make America great again. Now, if you're Mike Pence, why do you do this? I say you do it because of two things. One, you either think that Trump is not running and you want to be right there. And for all these other people to say they're on his little paint, whatever, that's interesting about another Trump run. But Pence doesn't care if he draws Trump's fury because, wait for it, he already has, right? You know, I mean, calling him all sorts of names for not doing illegal activities of the day of the Electoral College vote, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, that break was pretty clear and pretty strong, and you can say things to the contrary, but that break, you know, there are a lot of people holding back because they don't want Trump to be mad at him. Pence has already had that. And so he's not afraid to go out, because what's the worst thing that can happen? Trump's going to suggest that people should have him hung? He's already done that.
Exactly. Okay,
well, so how much worse does it get if you're Mike Pence? And so I find it interesting that was announced early this morning, late last night, early this morning.
Maybe they know something already, which I think we've been saying. I can't see Trump running again at this point. I will say this. Here's part of the problem, too, Republicans have. And this is maybe why Pence thinks he actually has a chance here, because I'd say, you know, 2 months ago he had no chance. But he might think he has a chance, at least for the RN, not for the presidency, but for the Republican nomination. Poll found that nearly half, 49% of Americans identify as Democrats or independents, leaning towards Democrats, while a combined only 40% are Republican or GOP leaning. The first quarter of 2021 advantage is the biggest since the fourth quarter of 2012, during which President Barack Obama won his second presidential election. Without including independent leaning one way or the other, Republicans fared worse, with 25% of the public calling themselves members of the GOP. Fewer percentage points higher than the Gallup poll's all-time low of 22% in 2013, Gallup found that 30% of Americans identify strictly as Democrats. So you have had, and this is not the only story, MSN actually had a story where they talked about the people are leaving the Republic. Ever since that January 6th insurrection, the Republicans have seen a very palatable, you know, exodus from the party, that is something that's undeniable. And, you know, what Pence could be looking at is, well, I'm still considered to be a moderate, at least in the party. Maybe that these people will come back to the fold.
Pence had a reputation. Well, he was the prototypical sycophantic vice president while they were in office. And that's the job, right? What's the job of the vice president? Support the president blindly, check on his or her health every morning to see if you're going to be pressed into service. And he embraced that role. And you knew when you took the job that's what you were going to do. All right. So, I mean, he entered eyes wide open. But at one point, multiple points, but there was a tipping point midway through after the midterm elections did not go as well as the Republicans had hoped. They did better than historically they might have done, but not as well as they had hoped. There were a lot of Republicans who said, I'm getting a little tired of the Trump act. If only we could have somebody like Pence and a platform like Trump. In other words, Trump-like policies without all the tweets and without all the spoiled little brat demonstrations. Now, I'm not saying that is valid, but I'm saying I did hear that from a lot of people. Now, Pence obviously is thinking, hey, look, I was the adult. I can carry out the policies and not have all the negative baggage associated with the Trump tantrums. And look at my credibility. I'm the one he suggested should be killed on January 6th. So he can separate himself. I don't know why I'm fixating on that one point. But the point is that Pence styles himself as the one who can carry out Trump policies without all the drama.
It's interesting because there's been a lot made out of Tucker Carlson now on Fox News. Is very pointedly trying to change the narrative of what the insurrectionists were doing at the Capitol on January 6th. On top of that, I saw an ad for a some sort of action committee with Scott Walker, Wisconsin GOP Scott Walker, and the language was, we got to fight. We got to fight to the death to make we stop these people. These people want to kill you. You need to fight back. It was the first time in a while I'd seen that level of rhetoric, which was very common in the GOP prior to the insurrection back again. There clearly seems to be an element here where if we're looking at this much of an exodus from the Republican Party, and this could eventually affect them, they've got to keep people in the base. And so it seems to me that this is – it's almost like on one side you got Pence. On the other side, you've got these people who are going, no, 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 no. Those insurrectionists were really actually heroes. Don't label them as traitors. They were just innocent people who got lost in a bus tour, I guess. And, you know, completely ignoring the fact that how many officers were injured, one officer was killed. They don't want to talk about that, but they're clearly trying to change the narrative here because I think they can see this is a problem. Where the Republican Party goes from this point is a real big problem for them.
Motive means everything. Always has, but it's especially true now. Tucker Carlson has a brand new show that debuted this week on the Fox Nation streaming service.
Bull.
I'm sorry, I just warned you that I was going to mention all of that. So the point is, hey, I've got a shiny new show, part of my big brand new contract. Is it a coincidence that some of his narrative changes this week? Okay, I believe you used to refer to the governor of Wisconsin as Little Scotty Walker.
Little Scotty Walker.
So now I see him tweeting about, oh, so Delta, I don't need a photo ID before I board your plane anymore, right? It's like, okay, where did he come from? I suppose maybe he never really left, but now he's elevating his profile. See, everybody's got a motive. And it's just fascinating how quickly, to your point, the narrative turned. Look at the public opinion polls about Trump's popularity. It is back to where it was before January 6th. That's only 3 months, right? I mean, it's just amazing how fickle. And again, it depends on who's taking the poll and what they ask, and I get all that. But it's just fascinating how quickly everything turns. And so I'm watching motives of people who have brand new TV shows, who have books to shill, who are out of power and desperately want to get back. I mean, Governor Walker was supposed to be the shoo-in at the Iowa straw poll in Ames that year.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember being there on the grounds, and it was a little shaky, and then he was out.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, he was out after that weekend. Was that the Michelle Bachmann RV year, I'm thinking?
She loved those corn dogs.
Well, really?
Well, dear Lord, did you
really
see?
Thought
only
really
Rick, thought only Rick, was... only Rick Perry enjoyed a corn dog in Iowa more than Michelle Biden.
Well, she was born here.
Yeah.
So literally 3 blocks from where I'm sitting right now, there's a sign. No, there's no sign. But in any case, that's where she declared she was running for president. It was in the shadow of her girlhood home. But in any case, people have. I mean, Scott Walker thinks, oh my God, how did I miss this? And he's never lost it, right? I mean, any of these people – here, I'll do both sides to it. In both parties, once you run for president, you never get out of your mind that you should be president. And so if Walker is sitting there saying, well, I'm not doing much these days, yeah, okay, elevate your name recognition and see if somebody will give you some money to keep yourself afloat a few years.
Jeff Stein joining us. Well, let's take a break. Let's come back. Let's talk about the sad, sad tale of Mitch McConnell when we do return. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. Jeff Stein joining us for his usual weekly visit. Jeff, Mitch McConnell is having all sorts of fun. He, of course, Georgia passes their new somewhat restrictive voter laws down there. Immediately, a lot of businesses have some problems with it, including Major League Baseball, who withdraws the All-Star game out of Atlanta and moves it to Colorado. Delta Airlines as well, who is mostly headquartered down there. They basically, their executives start lashing out at this law. Mitch McConnell initially says, how dare you, as executives, you know, criticize what we're doing, immediately says, he tells them to stay out of, you know, GOP business, then comes back and says, oh, by the way, your donations are still welcome. Now today he's actually come on out. It's like, oh, they're more than welcome to speak their mind because they must have been realized, okay, now we're really kind of, kicking ourselves right in the old cahoots. So, Mitch McConnell, I think that first time he said it, when he basically was saying, executives stay out of this, I just don't think he understood what he was saying when he said it.
Oh, just that.
Oh, yeah.
As opposed to anything else that he hasn't figured out over the course of however long. Look, no love lost for Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, or thank you very much, Mitch McConnell. He gets up and says businesses need to stay out of politics. In the middle of that rant, he even comes back and says, but your donations are welcome. How absolutely, incredibly duplicitous can you be, and yet nobody was surprised by it?
Slightly crazy.
That bothers me the worst. That bothers me more. No one was surprised that he was that honest about it. Business should stay out of politics except when I want your money. Oh, my God. Gosh.
Well, it was so crass, but I mean, there is an underlying tone, and it's not something other businesses. I mean, as the same Republicans scream cancel culture about a Dr. Seuss book, they're trying to cancel a lot of things right now. The you know, clearly there's an undertone message here, which is this: we have kept wages down. We have not raised the minimum wage. We have been fighting this healthcare thing. We have tried to get rid of as many unions as we possibly can. We have done this for you. Now, you know, sit down, shut up, and let us do this. I mean, that's kind of there is that point of like, wait a minute here. Why are you coming after us now? We've been doing so much for you guys for the last 40 years.
Well, it's nice for those elected officials to know how the public has felt all this time. It's kind of like, hey, you know, we supported you. Why aren't you doing things for us? You know, why have we not had a minimum wage increase in generations? The hollowness with which all of these statements ring these days, it's a reason why everybody's leaving these political parties, as you mentioned in the prior segment. I mean, the statistics show it. People are tired of it, and that explains why the Trump phenomenon started. And the question is, will there be somebody else to catch that wind going forward?
Well, and Biden seems to be doing a pretty good job right now, to the chagrin of the Republicans. Jeff Stein, once again, will spotlight this interview. Hour two, that's coming up next. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. On your Wednesday, once again, we will spotlight Stein out there. I would love to get Stein out to the Blue State Ball. I know the chat feature will kind of go nuts, but it'll be fun. He's been on the show forever. I've actually talked to him for what, 30 years now.
Wow, then, 30. Yeah, I know you've talked with him in previous radio lives.
Yeah, well, actually, no, 20 closer to 25, closer to 25. But still, I mean, I've been talking for him a long time.
You were talking about Clinton back in the day, weren't you, with him?
We were. As a matter of fact, gosh, yeah, we used to talk about the impeachment trial of Clinton. We'd talk about that. So I've got a story here that just it's going to hit a lot of bells and whistles right here, all right? The COVID-19 pandemic provided quite a boost for delivery sales at Edina's three municipal liquor stores. The Edina Liquor did $2 million in sale via its home delivery service. That's nearly 30 times the amount it did in 2019, when sales through home delivery totaled $70,000. They have done $2 million in Edina alone on booze delivery. My God. City launched its delivery service 2019 is becoming increasingly more popular in the months leading up to the pandemic.
Lizzie Dinah, they could just be ordering more quality than quantity.
I've lived in Edina. I know exactly what's going on. In January 2020, Edina Liquor was processing 12 to 15 orders per day. In early March, before the state's lockdown, it was getting 35 to 50 orders per day. Edina General Liquor General Manager Josh Furbish told Bring Me the News, when the city closed its liquor stores to in-person shoppers for 7 weeks, starting on March 18th, online delivery orders spiked to 200-plus per day, peaking at 465 orders in one day. This is a Facebook post the Edina Liquors people put out. To our customers and residents, we have mentioned in previous communications we continue to adjust to our operations to the best interest of our staff, customers, and community. Due to increase in demand, we have decided to temporarily suspend our delivery service for Sunday, March 22nd and Monday, March 23rd, in order for time for our staff to restock. They literally are selling out the entire store. And they... well... I'd be remiss if I didn't get a comment on this from, of course, Edina guy.
let me tell you. Mass. yes, you brabbleskabion. Yeah. Forgive me. Delivery just came not that long ago. I know you inferior types over in some of these neighboring suburbs. I know you guys like to think you're a Edina material. But have you ever bazooka-chugged a delightful Cabernet Sauvignon? Oh, it is delightful. I need my booze. I need my liquor. It's so hard for me. So you keep your prying lips out of my business, Mr. Macklesen. When I want to hear from you, you trained chimp, I'll call your mom. I think I need to lay down.
Ladies and gentlemen, Edina guy, drunk off his gourd.
Took a lot of voice combinations there.
Well, I mean, he's been drinking. I mean, did you ever see Thurston Howell the Third on Gilligan's Island get fermenting, making, yeah. But needless to say, it's daiquiri time. Wow. 400. They had to shut down the municipal liquor stores. Shut them down because they had drained the stock. How many bottles are they delivering on each of these orders?
That's a good question.
Hello there. I need my usual weekly intake. 16 bottles of gin. I need 4 cases of wine. I need, a fine pilsner. I'll let you choose something appropriate for me in Edina. Of course, I need my,
I'm gonna stop before I get myself into trouble. I should, by the way, mention to anyone out there, any Republican who ever says to me that government shouldn't get into business, well, then your first problem should be with the Edina liquor stores, because the city of Edina runs those municipal liquor stores. So until you demand the liquor stores in Edina shut down because they're run by the city government, then your argument is moot. All right? There you go. That's what I want to make sure I said. I have no problem with it. But it's these Republicans who are demanding, it's like, no government agency ever ran anything as good as a private business. Well, then you're demanding the Edina liquor stores. And I guarantee you that will shut them up really quick, because no Republican wants to be responsible for shutting down the liquor stores in Edina. No one wants to. 952-946-6205. All right. Let us we've got to get into the more serious story for today, and that's, once again, it is the Derek Chauvin trial. The next hour, a good chunk of it is going to be going over what happened today. I had an interesting discussion with someone last night who said he thinks he knows a lot about law. He says, I think that Chauvin's a lawyer is making a mistake here by basically doing an all or nothing strategy, because you can't deny the fact that George Floyd was not moving, not complaining, was dead underneath their legs, underneath their knees. And your argument that he didn't, because once again, the defense's argument is clearly that, you know, that Derek Chauvin did not kill George Floyd. It was the mean crowd that prevented Derek Chauvin from stopping them, which I got. Oh, Chauvin is slime. He is slime. I'll get to that in a second. But these ideas, like, he had drugs. I don't care if he was doing drugs. We do not have the death penalty for drug use. And he clearly, with the video, was not struggling, was not fighting, wasn't doing anything. Once you got him on the prone position and you got the handcuffs on him and you put your knees on him, he wasn't struggling. And for 9.5 minutes, you stayed on his back. That was murder. You murdered him, you officers. You murdered him. But yeah, that's their argument. It was we didn't kill them. The crowd killed them because they were upset because we were killing them. Okay, and that, you know, he really died of drugs, not the fact that he clearly was being pinned to the ground on the neck by the knee of Derek Chauvin. The LAPD, starting off from where they ended yesterday, LAPD sergeant again gets to the stand. This is the expert that the prosecutors brought in. He asked to describe each photo. He starts showing him a bunch of photos. The first is when officers remove Floyd from the squad car, put him on the ground. The second is when the paramedics arriving at the scene. The third is Chauvin's knee on Floyd's neck and the right knee in the back. The fourth and fifth also show images of Chauvin on top of Floyd. The exhibit is now published. The still images show Chauvin kneeling on Floyd with the two other officers on his lower body. This still is from the city camera. Two other images show Chauvin kneeling on Floyd. Schleicher asked the sergeant to confirm that Chauvin's position and body weight pressure on Floyd doesn't seem to change over time, which it doesn't. Then you discover this little nugget. So we found out in the first days of the trial itself that there were multiple people that were begging Derek Chauvin to get off of George Floyd, and that Derek Chauvin, to them, appeared to look at them with a smug look and drive his knee harder into the back of George Floyd's neck. We heard that. Now we actually have photo proof that Chauvin is doing a pain compliance tactic on Floyd's left hand. As Floyd's hand is handcuffed behind him, as Derek Chauvin is on his back, he is defenseless. Chauvin was intentionally hurting George Floyd by applying pain tactics to his hand. He was not only was he driving his knee into the back of George Floyd's neck, he was actively trying to hurt him for hurting him's sake. There was his hands were in cuff. He didn't even have to grab his hand at all. And yet he is holding his hand and in trying to incite pain on George Floyd even more. This guy is just the devil himself. He is just the devil himself. Schleicher asked the sergeant about Graham versus Connor, a Supreme Court case, factors added to the Minneapolis police policies. The sergeant says that after reviewing the policies, Minneapolis police has added those which show its high pilot, you know, they highlight that in the image. The sergeant touches upon the three items highlighted. He confirms that the severity of the crime did not change over time. It was still the fake $20 bill. He confirms the second point, says poses an immediate threat, which he did not. And the LAPD sergeant says his opinion, once Floyd was in the prone position on the ground, handcuffed, not resisting, there should have been no force or restraint. Schleicher has the sergeant go over different allowable police responses according to the subject's behavior. Sergeant says the position that Chauvin was in, kneeling on Floyd while he was at the prone position, was deadly force. Schleicher asked the sergeant about experience using force and handcuffing someone in the view of bystanders and hostile crowd. The crowd to him is when the crowd is yelling and throwing rocks and bottles at him. Now, that was not what was going on at 38th in Chicago. The sergeant says he does not view the crowd on May 25th as hostile because they were just yelling and filming. He also confirms that the use of force used on that subject has been relative to the subject's behavior, not by the bystanders. Schleicher asks the sergeant if it's possible for the crowd to distract an officer. The sergeant says, yes, it's possible, but he doesn't believe it happened in this case because when Floyd would cry for help, Chauvin would respond to him. After Floyd called out for help and said he couldn't breathe for the first time, Chauvin remained kneeling on his neck for about 6 minutes, says the LAPD sergeant. Nelson is now cross-examining. He begins by asking the sergeant if he enjoyed the rain last night in Minneapolis. This is the defense attorney. Nelson has the sergeant confirm East Police Department has some different policies. I mean, he basically starts going through and trying to find any wiggle room he can to try to justify what Chauvin had done. And what it's – the idea is – I mean, what would be a good way to compare what they're doing on the defense? It's kind of like, sure, we nuked that country because they said they might install some trade policies with us. And that was a threat to us. So the interpretation was the threat was that great on just a few trade policies, we had to nuke them into a submission. That's kind of the if that's what it feels like sometimes with how the defense is trying to frame this. Sergeant says Nelson asked the sergeant to confirm he used his personal experience in the LAPD to form his opinions. Slicer asked for a sidebar, which was granted. Nelson asked the sergeant about trial prep with the prosecutor. Basically, he did not. He says no, he did not, because the defense was trying to make the implication that he was working directly with the prosecutors on the answers, and he said no, we did not do that last night. He asked if Sergeant Steiger reviewed the Minneapolis Police Department policy on inappropriates with Graham Connor decision. He said yes. Nelson reads from the policy, which says it's not limited to those three factors shown earlier by Schleicher. The policy says the on-scene officers need to look at the totality of the scene. It says sometimes use of force can be instantaneous, but not for 9.5 minutes, guys. Nelson says when the use of force is reviewed, there are multiple lawyers, the officer's training and experience, the surrounding circumstances. Nelson brings up the critical decision-making model. Nelson has Steiger confirmed that benign situations can turn into a risky situation. So I guess what the argument I got from that one was that he was saying that, yeah, well, just because he might get up, well, we better basically use deadly force because there's the possibility he could get up. Oh, they're going to put some trade sanction on us? Nuke them. See? Problem solved. You know, that sort of thing. Nelson asked Steiger about Chauvin Hurd from the dispatch. Nelson asked Steiger confirm what Chauvin knew, tall, possibly intoxicated person. Nelson mentions how when you consider the fact this is a forgery call, you wouldn't normally think this is a use of force case. Since it turned into that, a reasonable officer arriving at the scene would be heightened sense of concern. Nelson, but once again, once you had the handcuffs on him and he was on the ground prone and you got handcuffs on him, you should have set him upright. You should have turned him on his side. You didn't. You drove your knee into the back of his neck, for God's sakes. Nelson said that Floyd was saying he couldn't breathe as officers were trying to put him in the squad car. Steiger agrees. So basically says he said it one time that he doesn't have to pay attention ever again because he said it once and, I didn't want to listen to him then, so I'm not going to listen to him now. See, problem solved. Get really tired of this. Nelson asks if subjects can be a threat even if they're handcuffed. Steiger agrees. Nelson asks if possible to get an officer's gun when handcuffed. Steiger agrees. Not when you're holding the hand of the subject and emitting pain to the guy. Once again, George Floyd is handcuffed on the ground. Chauvin's knee to the back of his neck, and Chauvin was hurting his hand. How the hell you think he's going to grab anyone's gun at this point? Jesus. Nelson asked if the scene is chaotic. There's possibility to miss something. Steiger said that's possible. Nelson plays a video for Steiger or Floyd saying something when the prone position. He asked Steiger what Floyd says. Steiger said he couldn't make out what he said. That will come back a little bit later on. Nelson attempted to get Steiger to agree that Floyd said, I ate too many drugs, but Steiger responded that he couldn't hear what he said. Nelson then moved on. So basically what they're basically taking a video and this, you want how, I get it. The defense is trying to put out a defense, but the reality is you'll see when I get back to this, that what actually was said was not, I ate too many drugs, but this is the argument Nelson's putting forward. Nelson asks if Oscar's making a choice not to increase force can be seen as de-escalation. Nelson asked Steiger about Mrs. Frazier, who is a bystander in filming, about the bystanders. Nelson asked Steiger that you agree that police use of force can look awful. Steiger brings up that he started being an officer when Rodney King was when that incident happened. Nelson asks if you can tell through a camera if someone is tense or having a certain sensory experience, seemingly expecting Steiger to say no, but he says you can. Nelson was not expecting that answer. Court back in session. Nelson is back to talking about bystanders. Nelson is asking if the crowd's intensity increased as it went on. Nelson published the Minneapolis Police Department diagram of the appropriate use of force contingent and the subject's behavior. Steiger says it has to be proportional. Firearms training is brought up. Nelson says Steiger agree that you're trained to deal with the biggest threat first. So people swearing was what they dealt with was the biggest threat. Simply because a person is not fighting with you, that doesn't mean you can use some sort of force to control them. Nelson asks if Steiger agrees. He says it depends on the situation. Nelson asks if it ultimately depends on a reasonable officer's analysis. Steiger agrees, a reasonable officer. Nelson brings up the Minneapolis Police Phase 1 service defense tactics training for 2020. Nelson moves to be published. Judge asks their objections. Steiger agrees the reasonable officer would be aware of what the crowd is doing and that may distract the officer. Nelson asking Steiger over and over about the perceived threat of a crowd can have an officer. Steiger says name calling isn't necessarily a threat. Nelson continues the language some of the bystanders use. So, and this is where it gets ludicrous. I can't repeat what he says because he uses some of the phrases that were used in the videos. You're a blanking blank, Nelson said it loudly while pointing at Steiger and pacing back and forth. He asked if that can be seen as a threat. Steiger says yes, as a potential threat. Nelson asked Steiger about the kneeling on Chauvin. But, you know, once again, that was said once, a person that didn't attack you. And so you're saying that harsh language justified Derek Chauvin kneeling on George Floyd's neck for 9.5 minutes. No! See, this is why I'm so mad at this whole thing, is that this whole dog and pony show, and it's being pushed, I guarantee it's being pushed by Chauvin, because a guy that would try to hurt the hand of a guy he's got on the ground in cuffs with his knee on the back, this is the kind of guy who would throw rocks at a chipmunk. That's the kind of guy who does something like this. So I get the entire point of this entire trial feels like Derek Chauvin is basically just saying, no, I'm innocent. It was those people who were swearing at me because I was scared. Punk. He's just a punk. Oh. Nelson asked Steiger about the kneeling on Chauvin. He asked if Chauvin was kneeling on Floyd's neck. I tell you what, actually, I just realized where we're at in the time. We got to get a break in. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. More of the testimony today from the Chauvin trial. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. Once again, going through what the daily happening in the Chauvin trial today. Basically, we're with this LA expert at this point still, and he's talking about, they're doing this whole thing about why you wouldn't try to move a guy that's passed out off his belly, take the handcuffs off, because that's the policy. If someone's passed out, you take the handcuffs off and you try to revive them, and they didn't do that. The argument that the defense attorney is trying to make is that, well, you know, what happens if he becomes violent again? And, you know, so... Yeah, it's once again, it's they're trying to make excuses. He then tries to get the LA sergeant to basically admit that the knee wasn't on the neck, but he says no, it clearly shows him on it was knee on the neck. He then shows that one frame that they keep going back to say, well, that one looks like it's on his shoulder. And he says, well, yeah, that's at the end, though, but it's, you know, it does look like it's on the shoulder there, but was at the very end of it. That's the image that they pull up. Redirect now, Slicer redirecting. He shows the video when Floyd is partially in the squad car. Steiger agrees that it looks like Floyd may have been emotional distress and the reasonable officer would have taken that into account. Steiger says the use of force used by Chauvin on Floyd was excessive. Slicer asks if the officer can opt not to believe the suspect when they say they're having a medical problems or in distress. Steiger says no, they need to take care of what they say into account and are responsible for their care. Steiger says after someone is handcuffed while in a prone position, then they need to put it on their side in the recovery position. Nelson, once again, recrossing, asks if Steiger was there that day. He says he wasn't. Nelson asks how many reviewers took use of force investigation. Nelson asks why the review board of five, basically, he was excused. I mean, after, you know, it was a nice job by the prosecution to bring that back and say, you know, let's rerun through the things that he should have done and he didn't do. And really, the defense didn't have anything to go with it. Next up is James Ryerson. He is the licensed as a peace officer. He started with the New York PD. He's with the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. So these are the guys that investigate cops when they're involved in a potential crime. Ryerson also worked for the DEA, specifically dealing with drug cartels. Ryerson hired by the BCA in 2018. So this was the guy that was called out to be the lead investigator on the May 25th case in the death of George Floyd. Ryerson said he was called about 9:45. On May 25th, he, Agent Phil, and another agent met at City Hall. The BCA has critical incidents protocols. When Ryerson arrived at City Hall, he learned of the four involved officer as part of the critical incidents protocol. Pictures of the involved officers were taken, according to Ryerson. Chauvin was, you know, they showed a picture of Chauvin, the image from him that was taken that day. Ryerson acquired all the body-worn cameras, downloaded the footage and weapons from the officers, the radio conversations, the 911 calls, etc. Ryerson then went to the scene on May 25th. Incident about 2 a.m. At that point on May 26th. The crime scene team arrived. The team leader was Mackenzie Anderson. She shows up a little bit later on. Ryerson recalls seeing the squad police squad car in Floyd's personal vehicle. At the scene, he saw a manila envelope with two $20 bills inside. He seized it for evidence. They went to lunch then they came on back. I'll tell you what, let's take another break right now. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Take another break, come on back, and get into the afternoon activities with the Chauvin trial. 952-946-6205. Let me complete that. 952-946-6205. It's the Matt McNeil Show on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. Getting back to the testimony from the Chauvin trial from today. Okay, they come back from lunch. Once again, Ryerson, this is the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension guy that came in to investigate. Anytime there's a crime potentially involving police officers, he was called in. He was the lead investigator at that time on the night of the 25th. The bills were sent. They were found an envelope. There was a pipe, cigarettes, and two $20 bills. The bills were sent to the FBI for investigation. One of the bills is torn. The pipe was given to the BCA for testing. Squad car and Floyd's vehicle are brought into a secure location where the crime scene investigators processed them on May 27th. Ryerson said he watched more security camera footage acquired from May 25th. When Exhibit 1 is published, it's a bird's-eye view diagram of the incident's location. Ryerson checked the timestamps of the videos. The Cup Foods video was 45 seconds ahead of the body-worn camera videos. The Dragon Walk video was 24 minutes ahead of the body-worn cameras. Dragon Walk did not want to give over their footage, so the BCA wrote a search warrant out. Exhibit 52 is published, the video from Dragon Walk outdoor security camera outside showing Floyd and another individual, apparently Maurice Hill, exiting Floyd's vehicle and crossing the street to Cup Foods. Frank is one of the state attorneys, and Nelson are conserving about Exhibit 155, or excuse me, 55 with the audio cut off. Frank says he'll come back to that later. He now asks Ryerson about the autopsy. He asked if a blood sample was taken from Floyd. The BCA received a sample for testing. Prior to testing, Frank asks if Ryerson knew of potentially preliminary drug use. He says from recordings he listened, he knew there was a possibility. Ryerson talks about the processing of Floyd's vehicle. The vehicle was first brought to the secure lot. Crime scene tape placed around the vehicle to make sure no one entered it before processing. The defense team got to look at the squad car in the secure lot and noticed a pill and asked for it to be processed again. The vehicle went back through the BCA garage. Funny, the defense team went in there and they found, hey, look, there's a pill in here. I find that very interesting and suspicious. That's just me, though. Ryerson received medical records from two hospitals about Floyd, including the Hennepin County Medical Center. Frank is asking about the technical side of the squad car that is the hybrid vehicle. He asked Ryerson if it's a catalytic converter. He said yes. Frank is now publishing 127. He wants to focus on the timing of the video. He is asking what Ryerson sees in the video and when Floyd is first put in the prone position on the ground. Ryerson says Chauvin's left knee appears to be on Floyd's neck. Frank asks if there's a time in Darnell Frazier's video where Floyd stops being verbal. Ryerson says yes. Frank shows the video up to the time where Floyd stops talking. It's also when the liquid streams away from Floyd's body. Frank is in the video stops at 20:25:08, and when Floyd appears to be not moving at all. Frank plays the video for over 2 minutes longer, almost 3 minutes. When the paramedics first arrive, Floyd is still not moving or speaking. As the video continues, it shows Chauvin finally stand up off of the Floyd and grab his right arm and pull his limp body onto his left side as Chauvin begins dragging his body towards a gurney. Now, I'm no medical expert, but the dragging of a body is not exactly, I think, what you're supposed to do. This guy did not care. Meanwhile, one of the paramedics attempts to hold Floyd's head up. Frank is done questioning Ryerson. Nelson starts his cross-examination. Nelson asked Ryerson to confirm the number of BCA agents involved in the investigation, 50. Ryerson also confirms about 25 FBI agents involved. Ryerson confirms there were about 200 citizen witnesses interviewed. Nelson has Ryerson confirm that he and the other investigators compiled a ton of material and evidence, but not all of it was pertinent. Ryerson confirms there was individual police reports written and submitted about the case, 440 reports. Nelson asks about the tip line and how agents had to follow up on all of it. He says how the investigation has gone on since the incident happened. Nelson asked about the second squad car search, asked about the defense, which happened on January 2021. He asked Ryerson is suggesting the defense placed pills in the car, which Ryerson says, no, he was not suggesting that. I find it very interesting, though, that the defense team goes and looks at the car, a car that had already gone over and they'd already investigated, and lo and behold, the defense team finds a pill in there. Hey. So, you know, Ryerson says, though, he's not suggesting that. I find it a coinkydink. Either someone at the investigation, the BCA investigation, really is bad at their job, or, you know, maybe someone placed it there. I don't know who. I'm just saying that's an option. Nelson brings up the critical incident policy. Ryerson was on the scene when Floyd's vehicle was first searched. He says he was present for part of it. Ryerson says out of the 700-plus photographs he saw from the first squad car search, he didn't see any pills. Of the 700 photographs, 700 photographs from the first squad car search, there weren't any pills there. But lo and behold, when the defense team went and took a look at that, well, there's a pill there. Interesting. I'm just saying, Brett, isn't that interesting?
Oh, yeah.
Sounds interesting to me. What a coincidence. What a coincidence.
Just happened.
Yeah. Wow. Do we know if the defense attorney has X-ray vision? Is this like a Superman thing? Kind of a comic book thing going on? Do we know? Can't say for sure.
Yeah, for me. Maybe he does.
We don't know anything here. We're just reading the transcript of the trial today. Per the critical incident policy, all officers in the crime scene in the night of May 25th and the morning 26th had their body-worn cameras on. Ryerson looks annoyed as Nelson gets confused about the exhibit numbers. Nelson asks Ryerson if he heard Floyd say, "I ate too many drugs." Now, this is going back to the statement that they said, "I ate too many drugs." Nelson says the previous witness is the same. He now plays the video. Ryerson agrees it sounds like Floyd said that. Nelson asks if about the fluid coming from their body. He asks Ryerson if it appears to be fluid from the vehicle. Ryerson seems to agree with that. Frank is redirecting. He asks if the hybrid squad car and the AC can run with just the battery and not the gas engine. Ryerson says yes. Frank brings up that Nelson showed a quick clip and asked before he played it for Ryerson if it sounded like Floyd said something specifically. Frank asked that if it was the first time Ryerson listened to the clip, Ryerson said yes. Nelson recrosses and asks Ryerson if he's a car mechanic. He says no. Nelson asks if he knew if the car was running with gas or electric. Ryerson says no. Nelson is done. The court is discussing in private for 10 minutes about a specific exhibit. The jury left the room. After more than 20 minutes, the jury came back. Frank is now re-showing the video again in longer length than Nelson showed earlier when he was asking Ryerson what Floyd said. When rewatching it, Ryerson said he heard Floyd say, Ryerson said he heard Floyd say, "I ain't do no drugs." So that's what he actually said. But the defense is trying to, what is the defense twice today? Say, "I ate too many drugs." Now Ryerson says, no, he said, "I ain't do no drugs." So he actually, isn't it amazing that, that was kind of a push there, it seems like. "I ain't do no drugs." Nelson is now cross-fitting and questioning permission to publish a portion of a video. The outdoor Dragon Walk security footage in the video, Nelson asks what Ryerson sees. Ryerson sees the person with the red hat apparently throw something out of his backpack, and Ryerson is excused. So basically, when the defense was trying to push this argument saying that, that Floyd admitted to take drugs, but now you have Ryerson saying, "Oh, no, I'd not heard this. It sounds like what actually was said is, I want to read this verbatim, "I ain't do no drugs." So. Next on the stand is Mackenzie Anderson. I believe this is the officer that, I actually don't know if it's an officer. They list her as Mackenzie Anderson, so might just be an investigator. Anderson worked with the BCA Forensic Lab since 2009. DNA training program was a year long. 2014, Anderson joined the crime scene team, and in 2016, she became the team leader. The lab has different sections to process certain evidence, firearms, toxicology. To be on the crime scene team, Anderson had to go through trainings, including crime scene reconstruction and blood patterns. In the last year, Anderson went to about 30 crime scenes, which she says are more than normal. Anderson got a call to go to the scene on May 25th. She was team leader, and a technician and a photographer joined her. The crime scene team arrived at 1:15 a.m. May 26th. They were there for 2 hours. When they arrived, they got a briefing from the agent in charge. They learned that Cup Foods employee called 911 about a possible counterfeit bill. Then officers arrived and tried to arrest Floyd. Then after he was in custody, he went unconscious, was taken to the hospital. Oh, no, he was killed, and then he was taken to the hospital. Anderson realized that there wasn't much evidence to be processed on the scene. She ended up watching a video of the incident, which informed her and her team where Floyd was on the street. She didn't see anything there. Exhibits 129 to 135 were received. 129 is published. Exhibit 131 shows Floyd's vehicle was a squad car parked behind it. Exhibit 134 shows squad car 320 in the background, and Cup Foods is on the left. It had rained since the incident. The pavement is shining with rain. After leaving the crime scene, the team agreed on a time to process the vehicles. On May 27th, Anderson says it is customary to wait a day to process. They started processing the vehicles at 9 a.m. on May 27th. It was Anderson and two others. The first step is photographing and documenting the outside, then opening the doors and taking photographs of the interior. After that, they start going through the contents of the vehicle. There really was very little, Anderson says, the amount of evidence on content. Frank then offers exhibits 137 to 149, which are photographs taken from Floyd's vehicle on May 27th. Anderson talked about the information she had about the vehicle, and there was potentially some blood or potentially counterfeit money. Anderson thought there might be some blood because she heard there was a struggle between Floyd and the officers and heard there may be blood from his nose or mouth. She did not know anything about the possible drug use at the time. Exhibits 38 show the driver's side of Floyd's vehicle. Exhibit 39 shows the passenger side. Exhibit 42 is taken from the front passenger side, showing the front console. A white pill is seen in the center front console. Exhibit 140 is in the rear seat. Exhibit 141 is in the trunk. Evidence 1046 shows an open and empty box of Suboxone, which is a prescription treatment for opiate addiction. Evidence 1046, and these two photos are from the January 2021 search. So exhibit 147 shows an unopened box of Suboxone. Exhibit 148 shows a white pill in the front console. Anderson's, they found two pills. That was once again from January 2021. Anderson now talks about the search of the squad car. This picture is on the driver's side of the rear seat. Exhibit 160 is the rear seat of the squad car. One of Floyd's shoes is on the floor. Exhibit 159 shows the rear door of the passenger side. Exhibit 169 shows white tags on the car seat. The red circle shows where the white pill was not taken out of the vehicle or processed because Anderson was not told to look for pills or drugs, so she actually did not know it was necessary. So apparently the pill was in the car. So they did, that does sound like they did a very good job. The two pictures are from Anderson searched the squad car again and took the pill into evidence. Evidence 51, evidence 52 is the white crushed substance that Anderson says could be a portion of evidence 51. Anderson did DNA testing evidence 51. She tested it and there was a saliva on it, which was, there was. So she tested it for DNA. Anderson explains the process of testing for saliva. Anderson found that the swab collected the pill matched a sample of Floyd's DNA. Evidence 53 was another piece of evidence found in the squad car during the second search. A brownish-red substance, Anderson said. She thought it had a similar markup to the evidence of 51-52. And the white stickers of the photograph show bloodstains in the rear seat of the squad car. By the way, I want to be very clear here. When we went to show, this is all since the last, when we went to show. When we went to show, we still didn't have the answer to that pill. Now we have the answer to that pill. So I want to clarify that. When we started the show, this had not been determined yet as far as testimony, that the pill actually was in the car, and for some reason they just left it there. So they show blood stains on the rear seat of the squad car, more stickers, basically it's standard processing stuff. Anderson says after testing the blood for DNA, she found that it was Floyd's blood. About a 10-minute break, it came on back. Nelson decided not to cross-examine. Anderson was excused. All right. So no cross-examination of McKenzie Anderson. Brianna Giles. Brianna Giles is now the witness. She's a forensic scientist with the BCA. Giles tests substances and see what controlled substance may or may not be present. She tested a glass pipe that was taken into evidence. She performed presumptive test, color test by scraping out residue. The results of the testing came out with THC, a main psychoactive ingredient in marijuana. No plant material was found, only charred residue. Evidence 48, where, by the way, it should be mentioned that in many states in the United States, that is a legal thing to carry. So as much as they might want to try to make an issue out of, he smoked dope, well, so does everyone in Colorado, apparently, legally. So, and New York City and California. So, evidence 48, two white round tablets, pills with apparent pharmaceutical markings, RP on one side, the numbers on the other. At first, Giles tested one of the pills for pills that have markings. She takes the weight and then looks up the markings, then does a confirmatory test. She used a razor blade, takes a scraping of the pill. She then tested evidence on 51, which is partial white and pink tablet with no observable markings. She cut part of it off to test. The result was methamphetamine. There was also trace amounts of other substances in evidence 51. 52 was also tested as partial evidence of the tablet. The result was methamphetamine. 53 was also tested as similar appearance. It was also methamphetamine. Nelson cross-examines and confirms he tested the weights of the substances. Nelson asked about 51. It looked almost like a pill, but I said it looked like a partial pill. Nelson asked Giles confirm where the substances came from, that 48 came from the front console of Floyd's car. The others came from the squad car. Nelson asked Giles if the trace amounts found in the pills was fentanyl. Giles says she cannot say. Nelson ends questioning. Giles is excused. Once again, I want to make sure I know why the prosecution is bringing this in here. They do not want to make it seem like they're trying to hide this evidence. But at the same time, you know, regardless of what drugs George Floyd took, you do not have the death penalty in Minnesota. You do not have the death penalty in Minnesota for drug use. And you do not have the death penalty in Minnesota for drug use administered by a police officer on the scene of the crime. That's just not an option. So you can say, well, he had drugs. Well, yeah, he might have had them. But the reality is this. That's not a death penalty. And nor are you going to say that every person in this city, in this state, that is taking an illegal drug needs to be put on the ground for 9.5 minutes with a knee to their back and their neck and kill them? Dear Lord. 952-946-6205. We're only got about an hour left of the testimony to go through for the day, so we'll come break that down here when we come on back. 952-946-6205. It is the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. Wrapping up the testimony from today, Susan Leith, L-E-I-T-H, is now on the stand. She used to do animal testing. She worked for NMS Labs as a forensic chemist. She does drug testing for controlled substances, pharmaceutical drugs. She also does peer review of others' data. Leith explains how when testing drugs, she runs three separate times to find the meaning of those triplicates. They corrected this on the Unicorn Riot thing. It's Susan Neith, N-E-I-T-H, N-E-I-T, Susan Neith. She explains the intricacies of drug analysis and how there is a peer review process standard for NMS Labs. Neith received three pills, partial pills from BCA to test. She didn't find anything out of the ordinary with them. She observed that the first tablet was partially white round. Evidence from 51 on the partial tablet was white and red. There's no writing on it. Findings for the first and the 48 was her findings for the first and 48 was that the fentanyl concentration was less than 1% and methamphetamines was 1.9%. The second was 48% was less than 1% fentanyl. Meth was 2%. Items 51, fentanyl was less than 1%. Methamphetamine was 2.9%. Neith confirms the amount of fentanyl is common with what she has seen. The amount of methamphetamine found is low for what she's actually seen. She usually sees 90 to 100%. Nelson goes to cross-examine, does not cross-examine. Neith is excused and court is adjourned for the day. So what can you take away from today? The prosecution has to bring all this stuff out. Because if they don't, it looks like they're trying to hide it. And at the end of the day, and I want to repeat this, I don't care that George Floyd might have been doing drugs. I don't care. There might have been a $20 counterfeit bill. What I care about is that when three officers particularly, put a man on the ground and then handcuff them in the prone position on the ground, it's clear at that point they are supposed to roll him off his belly, put him on his side, or sit him up on the counter, on the curb. That's what, or make them stand. That's another thing that they've said they're supposed to do. That's what the minute they get handcuffed. If a person that is under being restrained loses consciousness, they're supposed to immediately remove the handcuffs and try to revive the individual. None of that happened. For 9.5 minutes, George Floyd had Derek Chauvin's knee to the back of his neck. And I don't care if he was taking drugs. I don't care if he smoked pot. I don't care if he had some meth. He didn't deserve to be murdered like that in the street. No one does. And this entire ludicrous argument that the big, bad, mean crowd, they use the F word. That they somehow were responsible for Derek Chauvin keeping his knee in the back of George Floyd's neck is beyond ludicrous. Is beyond ludicrous. I just the way that the laws in this state are written by Republicans is that all an officer has to do is say, I was scared. We saw this with the Yanez trial when he shot Philando Castile, is that he basically just screamed, I was scared. And he murdered him. And thanks to the Republican Party in Minnesota, that's legal to do. They all have to do is say, I'm scared. Now, one can make an argument. If you're that scared, you probably shouldn't be a police officer. I know. That's a question that probably should be asked. But that's the way the Minnesota Republican Party has written the laws, because they don't want any cop ever held accountable. Here's the situation, which is very different. It wasn't an instantaneous death. This was a 9-minute and 30-second killing of George Floyd. And so, and you can't, he can't say I was scared of George Floyd when he's handcuffed on the ground, Chauvin's knee to the back of his neck. And so the I was scared defense is going to the crowd, that the reason why he had to kill him, the reason why he had to put his knee to the back of his neck, the reason why is because the crowd were saying swear words. Every expert has said the same exact thing. Every expert, that there are so many violations of policy here. There's no other way you can consider this outside of murder. It was, this guy got murdered. Now, they didn't say the murder part, but they said, oh, no, this is, he contributed to the death of George Floyd, for sure. His actions did. The one thing I want everyone to take away from today, though, there's a one thing. As George Floyd was handcuffed on the ground face down with two officers on his legs and Derek Chauvin driving his knee to the back of his neck, even though he clearly was not a threat, Derek Chauvin was inflicting pain on his hand just to do it. He was hurting George Floyd out of spite. That is disturbing. And that's your Minneapolis Police Department. We are back tomorrow. Until then, see ya.